Hey guys, welcome to this week's episode of Lost Origins, your number one radio show for all things ancient mystery, alternative historical theory, and lost civilizations. Check us out online at lost-origins.com and sign up for that free newsletter. We've got some really exciting competitions and contests that we're going to roll out for you guys within the next couple weeks, and they are only going to be available to people that are subscribed to our newsletter. So it's 100% free. You can have at it online. Just go to our website and you can make it happen. You guys can also connect with us on social media. We are on almost every single platform, and we are very active on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. So make sure that you guys hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode or an article from your friends here at Lost Origins. This week's episode of Lost Origins is brought to you by Worldviews Media. Worldviews has two incredible events coming up later this month in Sedona, Arizona, with Robert Bouval, a name that I'm sure every single one of you are familiar with. So on May 27th, Bouval is going to be speaking at the Sedona Creative Life Center. Doors open at 6 p.m. And on May 28th to May 30th, Bouval and Worldviews Media will be facilitating day trips through the ancient Southwest. So you'll be able to go along with Robert Bouval and check out the Verde Valley ruins, museums, petroglyph sites, and much, much more. So that's definitely an event that you want to be at if you can. Bouval's work is truly fascinating, so you don't want to miss it. Head over to worldviewsmedia.com/seminars. Views is spelled V-I-E-W-Z, and you can snag up your tickets there. This week's episode of Lost Origins is also brought to you by our friends over at Inner Traditions and Baron Company. Inner Traditions has been publishing books on esoteric philosophy, New Age spirituality, and alternative health for well over 40 years. You can check out their website at innertraditions.com. You can learn about their authors, their books. You can sign up for coupons, catalogs, special offers. They offer books on so many different topics, and we love their stuff on ancient mysteries. I mean, we read so many books here at Lost Origins, and we have never been disappointed by anything that has come out of Inner Traditions and Baron Company. So head over to their website. Pick up a book. You won't be disappointed. I am so excited for today's show, you guys. For as long as I can remember, I have just been fascinated with all things Knights Templar and all the stories surrounding them, all the lore, the myth. It just blows my mind. And so today we get to chat with author, researcher, and descendant of the Templars, William F. Mann. William has authored several books on the Templars, including The Templar Meridians, The Knights Templar in the New World, as well as a book that he has coming out later this month titled Templar Sanctuaries in North America. So today, we're going to be discussing The Knights Templar in America, The Holy Grail, and the secret mapping of the New World right after the break. All right, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. If you're just tuning in, today we are joined by author and researcher William F. Mann. William is a recognized authority on the Knights Templar, and having authored several books on the subject, including The Templar Meridians, The Knights Templar in the New World, as well as an upcoming release from him titled Templar Sanctuaries in North America. I am definitely looking forward to our conversation today, and it is my pleasure to welcome William F. Mann to this week's episode of Lost Origins. William, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Andrew. It's a real pleasure. I've been a follower of your program for a while now, and I know that you have a variety of guests. And I think what we're going to talk about today is going to be just as exciting as some of the other programs that I've heard.
You know, I would agree. I've been a big fan of all things Knight Templar Knights Templar for as long as I can remember. So to have the opportunity to talk to somebody as versed on the topic as yourself, I think is just going to be an incredible experience. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And I tend to be my own biggest skeptic. It's really come as a surprise even to me in terms of my family background and my relationship to everything that we're going to talk about today. One thing that I find it's a real personal journey in terms of its lifelong learning, but also a realization of possibly what's in your subconscious, what's in your bloodline, and the ability to extract that prior knowledge from your bloodlines and the associations that come with it.
You know, I think that's a great place for us to kick off our conversation before we actually start digging into your research and your books. I think that it's important for us to discuss your background. Not only how did you get into writing these books, but your late great uncle was a Supreme Grandmaster of the Knights Templar up in Canada. And you're also a member of the Knights Templar, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And the branch that I belong to is a Masonic branch, and it's the same as my great uncle. It's known as Christian Masonry, and it's the highest level of masonry that one can achieve, really on both sides, from a Scottish Rite point of view and from a York Rite point of view. It's the highest level of masonry that you can achieve.
Wow.
And I'm very honored because it's a reflection and really acknowledgement of my great uncle, who was like my grandfather, because my grandfather died before I was born. Mm-hmm. So he really took over the guidance and the leadership of my lifelong learning.
Wow. And so it sounds like a lot of his views were instilled in you at an early age then.
They were, as I say, from almost a subconscious point of view. Only now do I realize 50 years later that some of the things that my great uncle would practice on me, he was practicing his own ritual. When I was 5 years old, some of the earliest things that I can remember is sitting on the couch and listening to my great uncle recite pages and pages by memory of certain ritual and ceremony, which to a five-year-old, it just appeared nonsense at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But you can imagine when you come to sit in the same chair, the presiding preceptor and the officer at Grand Council, and all of a sudden realize that you're following in the footsteps of your great uncle is really quite something.
Yeah, it must be pretty surreal. You know, I was doing some digging around online, and it seems that many factions are starting to come together because of this quote-unquote great treasure that is soon to be discovered. I thought that was intriguing and definitely befitting for our show, as we like to talk about ancient mysteries. Can you speak to that a little bit for us?
Certainly. And, you know, there's a positive side to that and there's a negative side. The positive side is that I always say that not one group or one individual per se has all the background information, all the answers to this great secret.
Mm-hmm.
On the negative side, I always find that, I'm finding that there's a variety of individuals and groups that really want to take not only sort of possession of the sacred knowledge, but also the claim that they are the guardians, the true guardians of the treasure. Now, in my mind, it's really kind of funny. I always get asked the question, well, what is the true treasure? And I always say to them, what do you think it is?
Mm-hmm.
But in my mind, the real treasure is nothing other than the knowledge that we've generated over the centuries, over the years, and the knowledge that is finally coming together, probably because in most part the advent of the internet, there's so much information out there. But a long time ago, that there was the same level of knowledge that really is accessible to us to this day.
Mm-hmm.
Knowledge which allowed the medieval Templars to circumnavigate the world and to complete a number of transatlantic journeys, to not only settle but establish refuge and sanctuaries across North America.
So with the transoceanic contact that took place pre-Columbus, which I do want to touch on here in a moment, you know, maps like the Piri Reis map or the Orontius Finius map, you know, a lot of these maps cite much older sources as the basis for which the cartographers mapped out these charts, right? Do you think that there's a connection between these maps and transoceanic travel that was completed by the Templars?
Absolutely. And I believe this is part of the knowledge that the Templars discovered under the ruins of the Temple of Solomon in the during the First Crusade. This information, there's a number of clues within certain Masonic circles that suggest that there was a certain level of knowledge, including maps such as this, that were preserved even before the Great Flood. And I believe that there was some semblance of this long-lost knowledge that was rediscovered by the Templars.
That's fascinating.
And perpetuated down through the ages.
Wow. That's truly fascinating. And I, you know, there's so much skepticism. You know, the internet can be such a positive thing and such a negative thing. You know, and we've posted several articles on the site that, that talk about maps like the Piri Reis map and Orontius Finius map. And they're met with such skepticism and apprehension, you know, and one of the things, one of the recurring themes that we mention a lot on this show is, you know, if it's just one example of something in history, that's quite simple to discredit or to chalk up to being coincidence. However, when you have multiple instances of it throughout several generations or thousands of years of history, that becomes a little bit more difficult to discredit. So I think that this is an interesting connection and one that, that I don't think has been talked about enough with regards to those maps. Back to pre-Columbian contact in America. There are many sites that demonstrate that, that the Vikings and the Templars did make it over here to America before Columbus, even though that that's not what we're taught in school and that's not, you know, the norm or the accepted view. There is a lot of evidence for that. Of the sites that you've explored and the sites that you've researched, which one do you feel is the most important example of Templar presence in pre-Columbia America?
The one that I think is probably the most important because it exists to this day is the Newport Tower. It's quite reflective of all the architecture that's associated with the Templar movement and the Cistercians, the development of not only their sanctuaries, but the development of their very extensive farming communities. To me, that's the most important. But the one that I identified through my first book, The Templars in the New World, I always go back to this notion that you build upon earlier foundations. And to me, it's very reflective of and supporting the notion that the Templars reestablished the sanctuary on top of Celtic Earth Fort. And that Celtic Earth Fort was, in fact, at one time assumed by the Norse, the Vikings, who we know established a number of communities. And very recently, there's been more recent discoveries in Newfoundland that suggest that the Vikings traveled all throughout North America and specifically down the northeastern coastline.
And so there's been when you say research, I'm sure like radiocarbon dating that's taken place in some of the organic material there. I mean, do we have any indication as to how much earlier the Vikings and the Templars were here in America before Columbus?
The notion that I've put forward in my book, and I think it's supported by a number of historical documents, that as early as 1126 were the Templars making transatlantic voyages. The Templars, what you have to do is you have to think like a medieval Templar. A medieval Templar, they possess the most advanced seafaring knowledge, the most advanced seafaring skills, and military tactics. And I believe that the Templars realized that as soon as they discovered the repositories of this sacred knowledge, that they would be hunted. They would be hunted by the church, by the Vatican and their agents for centuries to come. So I believe that they developed a strategy whereby they would establish sanctuaries and refuges in this new land, in the new world, North America, and constantly move across North America to the west, leapfrogging their own sanctuaries, and thereby being one or three steps ahead of, constantly of the agents that were sent out by the Vatican and the Church. And to me, they were following in, because if you look at one of the primary, the hereditary Grand Master in the Scottish Knights Templar in the late 1300s or 1400s, Prince Henry St. Clair, they were all Norse families. They all had as their root ancestor Rollo, who in essence established Normandy. And follow William the Conqueror. So all of this secret knowledge, Prince Henry St. Clair was a vassal or earl to the Queen of Norway. There was a vast depository or repository of knowledge that they were able to tap into coming from the north and bringing that knowledge with what they gained from the Crusades. So they were able to establish certain stepping stones or stations by which they crossed the Atlantic in the north. And to me, that's a very much a reflection of building upon these earlier foundations of knowledge.
Very interesting. And so you mentioned Henry St. Clair, and he's quite a crucial character in this story. You know, of your work that I've read, you know, the gist of Henry St. Clair is that he brought the Grail to the Americas, I believe, in 1398. And so because of books like The Da Vinci Code, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, the Grail has been described in many forms. And so you have put forth an interesting description of the Grail in terms of the ancient science developed before the Great Flood. And I think that's the key piece here. We do have to take a quick break, but William, when we come back, I do want to dig into your take on the Holy Grail, what you think it was, and what purpose it served. So we'll be right back with more from William Mann in just a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to this week's episode of Lost Origins. I'm your host, Andrew, and if you're just joining us, today we are talking with researcher and expert William F. Mann. William is a recognized authority on all things Knights Templar, and before the break, we were talking about Henry St. Clair. We were talking about who he was and his role in the Chronicle of the Templars. And so before the break, I had mentioned, William, that Henry St. Clair is known for bringing the Grail, among other things, obviously, but known for bringing the Grail to the Americas in 1398. And I mentioned that because of books like The Da Vinci Code or Holy Blood, Holy Grail, the Grail has been described in many forms. But in your book, Templar Meridians, you describe the Grail as an ancient science developed before the Great Flood. And I found this interesting, and that kind of goes back to what we were talking about the Piri Reis map and Orontius Finius map. But I would like to know, what do you think the Grail was? What was your description of the Grail, and what purpose did it serve?
Well, again, that's a very interesting question, Andrew. You know, people always ask me, is the Grail the venerated blood of Jesus Christ? Is the Grail certain relics, certain bones associated with the Holy Bloodline? Is the Grail were there actual members of the Holy Family that accompanied Prince Henry St. Clair and his Knights Templar and the Cistercians? I say all of those things. But to me, above all else, the Grail was this knowledge which allowed Prince Henry St. Clair and the Knights Templars that followed them to reestablish certain energy lines. I call them the Templar Meridians across North America, and thereby provide a certain locational through latitudes and longitudes, a certain location that could be followed by initiates that followed Prince Henry St. Clair, whether it was 100 years later or whether it was 600 years later, as I have done. To me, it was this sacred knowledge. Now, associated with that, if you believe that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were actually married, and Jesus was just a man, and that they produced offspring, mm-hmm. and that they are members of the holy bloodline, I believe that Prince Henry St. Clair was in possession of certain relics, certain artifacts, such as the bones through... what was discovered through the Talpiot tomb by the Knights Templar, the bones of not only Jesus, but Mary and other members of the Holy Family. But above all else, the Grail to me is the sacred knowledge, which allowed them to essentially perpetuate a level of science, a level of liberal arts and science that has been alluded to through certain Masonic ritual, old Masonic ritual. And in that manner, they were able to not only practice that certain science, but they were able to recognize similar forms of that science in the Native Americans that they met and over centuries they intermarried with, and in that manner developed a true brotherhood or guardianship between the Knights Templar and the Native Americans. And it's for that reason that we haven't been able to discover certain sanctuaries, because not only through my own family ties, but it's common knowledge that, as I talked about before, the Knights Templar, one of their strategic military tactics was to assume earlier foundations. And the Templars essentially were absorbed into the Native American population over the centuries. And it was through those strategic intermarriages that they were able to travel across North America uninhibited and reestablish the sanctuaries of those settlements that had been established 2,000, 3,000 years beforehand.
And so you also mentioned that these ancient sciences were developed before the Great Flood. And I find that particularly fascinating. You know, there's however many hundreds of worldwide deluge stories across the ancient world. I mean, do you think that this is potentially knowledge that predates the flood that Plato described that destroyed Atlantis?
Well, I can only allude to it. I can only tell you so much, but I can tell you that I've been initiated into a number of what's known as the old Masonic degrees. And every one of those old Masonic degrees allude to certain knowledge that has been perpetuated from before the Great Floods. So, yes, I believe absolutely that that knowledge was either redeveloped in accordance with what they rediscovered, or that it was perpetuated just based on the Grail treasure that they uncovered under the ancient city of Jerusalem.
Wow, that's incredibly fascinating. So my next question is, you know, a couple weeks ago we had a Dr. Tudor Parfit on the show. And we had a great conversation about the Lost Tribes of Israel, and we also talked a lot about his work with the Ark of the Covenant. And we had a listener write in, and they wanted me to ask him, well, what do you think about the theory that the Ark is buried in Oak Island? And so I want to get your take on the theory that Sinclair brought the Ark of the Covenant over to the Americas. Do you think that there's a possibility that the Ark and the Grail could kind of be one and the same?
There is the possibility. There's much more possibility that there were a number of relics and artifacts that were hidden by the early priests following or during the destruction of the first temple. It's always alluded to within Masonic ritual once again. But to me, it's not only the Ark of the Covenant, but it's the science associated with the Ark of the Covenant. It's, and I'm sure that we could take 2 days to discuss what we believe to be the science associated with the Ark of the Covenant. But yes, but to me, again, I always tell people, don't get fixated on what the possible Grail could be. Think about what it could be used for, how that knowledge could be applied to what they were trying to achieve. In essence, they were trying to establish a new Jerusalem, really centered on an ability to practice whatever religion, to really allow the forces of nature to take hold in terms of your everyday life. And to me, that was the real treasure, that ability to elevate your presence amongst nature and to be one with nature. As the ancient Native Americans, through certain secret societies, such as the one that I belong to, the Yomdewin, the Grand Medicine Society, they were able to achieve that higher level of knowledge and apply it to the betterment of their society. Unfortunately, Europeans that followed after them felt that they could conquer nature instead of living as one with nature.
Interesting. And it seems like the, you know, technology is great. I work in technology, but it seems like the more that technology advances, the more disconnected we become with nature and the way that we used to interact with the planet.
No, absolutely. And unfortunately, that's the situation that, around the world now. Man has taken over in terms of trying to impose his will across the universe, across the world. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the end result has been everything from climate change to annihilation and genocide.
Right.
And there is that superior thought. You have to think in terms of, we always refer to the new world, but in many ways it was the old world. And the Europeans were imposing their will on the old world. And one thing that the Templars realized, and the Templars, I always tell people the Templars wouldn't even gotten ashore if they hadn't, through signs, seals, and tokens, indicated their knowledge that was on the same level as the native North Americans at that point in time.
Is there any evidence of the Templars having made it to Central America or Southern America? You know, I just got back from a week-long trip down to the Yucatan, and my wife and I, we were exploring some Mayan sites and talking to some locals, trying to match up that connection that Graham Hancock has presented that, you know, Viracocha from Peru is one and the same with Kukulcan, Quetzalcoatl, Caucasian bearded bringer of civilization and sciences to Central and South America. It's interesting, though, with the transoceanic contact that took place with the Templars. I mean, it makes you wonder, are those deities examples of Templar presence in Central and South America?
Oh, I would agree, absolutely. In terms of their descriptions, they were absolutely Templars, but or they would very much like Glooskap, the man god of the Mi'kmaq, eastern seaboard Native Indians. One thing that people fail to realize is that Tulum and Chichen Itza, they're actually positioned on the same meridian grid that I developed and labeled as the Templar meridians. So to me, that's absolute proof that either they shared that knowledge or they left that knowledge with Native Americans. But the Mayan are a great example in terms of being able to apply that knowledge. And it's really quite interesting. It's probably mind-blowing in many ways when I point out to people that ancient observatories through Central and South America are actually positioned on this grid pattern that I've rediscovered or recognized across the Americas. So as I label them Templar meridians, I believe the Templars were basing that knowledge on earlier knowledge that had been generated, say, 10,000 years ago through an advanced civilization prior to the Great Flood.
Wow. Let's talk a little bit more about the meridians that you've developed. Can you speak a little bit more to that? Are there any more significant sites that go along with Chichen Itza and Tulum?
There are quite a number of significant sites. Probably the best known site that we talk about is Oak Island. Oak Island is really well positioned. It's one of the starting points to the grid pattern that I rediscovered or developed across North America. you talk about Oak Island and whether it was the a repository site for the Ark of the Covenant. I believe that Oak Island has been assumed, once again, playing upon the earlier temporary foundations, was assumed by the British military in the 1700s for their own purposes during the British North America period and during the American Revolution period. Mm. Now, what's interesting about that is if you look at it, the majority of the upper echelon of the British military were all Masonic. The tunnels that were developed out of natural formations on Oak Island all correspond to certain signs and tokens associated with sacred geometry, which is associated with Masonic and Templar development. Mm-hmm. So the characters that are now on History Channel demonstrating that they know exactly where the treasure is on Oak Island have fallen for one of the bigger ruses that have been accomplished throughout the history of mankind. The Templars are probably laughing in their own grave in terms of what they've established. They used Oak Island for their own benefit, but after that, they've used it as a ruse. And for over 250 years, certain treasure seekers have failed once again to look beyond. Look beyond the times of when the Templars had moved inland. Hmm. The Templars wouldn't have left anything on Oak Island, that's for sure.
And if the Lagina brothers are listening right now.
Yeah. You know, I myself watched their series because I find it kind of fascinating.
Sure.
It's, okay, we didn't discover anything over here, let's drill over here. But that the whole point is that if they had thought about it, nobody should be drilling in the first place or digging in the first place. Because there's simple codes, Masonic codes that have been left on the island, that essentially show where the back doors to the underground system is.
Can you share any of those with us?
Unfortunately, obliterated the underground system as it existed.
Can you share any of those codes with us?
Well, I talk about those codes in my three books. It's funny at 3,000 years ago, it would have been the absolute knowledge. It was known as sacred geometry. Mm-hmm. It's Euclidean geometry, the stuff that we learn in high school to this day. Very simple geometry, but at that time, it would have been pure magic. And it was essentially Euclidean geometry that allowed the ancients to map the world as we know it.
Wow.
So there's a hypothetical or theoretical application of Euclidean geometry known as the squaring of the circle. So there's a number of diagrams that I developed that are contained within my books that can apply exactly to the underground waterworks that you find on Oak Island.
Hmm. Wow. Let's shift focus real quick. You have a book coming out, I believe, the 28th of this month, correct?
Correct.
Templar Sanctuaries in North America. I was doing some reading on it this morning. It looks fascinating. What can you tell us about this book? What are you looking to reveal to your readers? What theories do you present? I mean, without giving away the farm here, what can you tell us?
Well, what's really surprising, I can give away the farm.
Cool.
In essence, what I've done is I've demonstrated the application of two main principles of masonry throughout the ages that the Templars applied in establishing their sanctuaries. And I've identified through its application where I believe the final sanctuary of the Templars lies. And it's, in essence, collaborated by instructions given by Thomas Jefferson to Meriwether Lewis and Clark. And it's where I believe, and if there are any Masons or readers of esoteric background listening, it's where I believe the ultimate sacred vault has been developed, and there's still a depository of, in essence, the physical treasure that the Templars, Prince Henry St. Clair, brought over, and that remains to this day.
Wow.
And people say, well, why didn't you go dig it up? Well, in essence, that's another moral story to my life learning process. It's not the treasure that I'm after. It's essentially the sharing of the knowledge. It's the reawakening of the Algonquin prophecies that said, now's the time for the bringing together of all mankind and the sharing of that.
Wow. And so that's out May 28th on Inner Traditions and Barron Company, correct?
That's correct.
Very cool. So how can people follow your work online? I mean, do you have a website that you
frequent?
Cool. Can you share that with us?
Sure. It's www.templars, with an S, New World, all one word, templarsnewworld.com. And they'll be able to read a lot more background in terms of what's being presented through the three books.
Very cool.
I've written the three books as I say, a learning journey of myself. But I have friends that always refer to me as sort of that satellite dish that gets 150 channels at one time. Every so often, you got to give it a kick, right?
In order
to align it back up. What I've done through my three books is essentially create a trilogy. And I follow the Templars across North America and provide the research and historical background justification as to why I believe the final resting place of the sanctuary lies where it does.
Very cool.
And I, in essence, challenge a number of the governments, including the U.S. government, to go and to dig this up and to use it for the betterment of mankind. It really shouldn't be shared among a small group, being Masons or non-Masons. It should be shared for all of civilization.
It'll be interesting to see the people that go after it after you put the theory out there. I think it'll be fun to bring you back on the show a year from now and look at everything that's happened since the book was released.
Yes, and there's a moral story to that. It'll be interesting to see who actually does go after it. And I won't give it away in terms of the final location, but it'll be interesting to see the local governments, how they react to the information that's being put out there. Will they dismiss it, or will they try to control it, or will they deal with it publicly? And essentially the latter is what I'm promoting.
That's awesome. Do you speak at any conferences, any events coming up that you're going to be at?
I do, but I haven't established really where I'm going to be at, so unfortunately I can't tell you. Unfortunately, or fortunately, I have one of those careers that I'm still very much involved in and working 24 hours a day. So you'll ask me, when do I have time to write the books? I really don't get much sleep, so I write between 4 and 6 in the morning. But it's been a lifelong journey, as I say. I've only written the three books in the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. But since I can remember, I've been immersed not only in Masonic ritual and ceremonies, but also Native American ceremonies because my mother was a Algonquin. So it's been an interesting melding of the two civilizations. And that's one of the main theories that I put forward in my third book. It's only through the strategic intermarriages of the Templars with the Native Americans was the sanctuaries that I've mentioned able to establish, but also there are current guardians of the treasure that still exists, and I'm one of them.
So the current factions of Templars are serving as guardians then?
Yes, that's correct. And through the prophecies, the Native American prophecies that were first introduced 400 years ago, the inclination was is that now is the time to make this information, this treasure, actually be known and dedicated to mankind for its betterment.
Wow.
Because right now, at this point in time, I see ourselves as being really involved in a very screwed up world.
Oh, for sure. I mean, we're definitely heading down a path of great progress with respect to our technology and our sciences, right? But we are such a destructive species. I mean, what we do to each other, what we do to the planet, what we do to—I mean, just it's just it's horrific to watch sometimes. And then you kind of
and it just disgusts me that around the world, what's the atrocities that are being done in the name of God and the number of wars that are being fought over God. If you think about it, the last 2,000 years, everything was done in every major event in history was on God's behalf, and it surprises me that everybody seems to think that their God is the supreme God.
Right.
I think there's a lesson to be learned here, and if nothing else, I'm hoping that my books will cause people to sit back and think.
Well, and maybe this ancient and secret knowledge that is about to be revealed will help solve some of these problems that humanity has created for himself.
I very much hope so. And if nothing else, if I can accomplish that, that would be a great legacy.
Yeah.
Not only for myself, but for my family and the honor of the my family members that have come before me.
I would have to agree with you. Well, William, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. It's been an incredible pleasure. I've thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. We really appreciate you coming on to Lost Origins and talking with us.
You're very much welcome, Andrew.
Very good. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this week's episode of Lost Origins. Make sure that you guys head on over to William's website, check it out. Learn as much as you can. The stuff you'll find there is absolutely fascinating. And head on over to our friends at innertraditions.com, and you can pick up his two previous books, and you can also pre-order his newest book that comes out on May 28th. You will not be disappointed. Make sure that you guys check in next week. We're bringing back an old friend. Mr. Carl Lerberger is going to be joining us once again to discuss ancient petroglyph sites here in North America that once again reinforced the diffusionist view of transoceanic contact before Christopher Columbus. So you definitely don't want to miss that episode. Hit that subscribe button, you guys. Make sure that you never miss an episode or an article from your friends here at Lost Origins. And until next time, I'm your host, Andrew, and I want you to continue to question everything.